This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldrock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast. My name is Darren Rockman, and I am a partner at Goldrock, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And I am very excited to have someone on the podcast that I've actually wanted to have for a very long time. Flora Sanhum joined us. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Darren. Lovely to be with you. How are you doing?
Terrific. Flora serves as Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem, where she was responsible for foreign relations, international economic development, and tourism. She's also co-founder of the UAE-Israel Business Council, an association of Emirati and Israeli businessmen and government leaders trying to foster bilateral trade, innovation, and cooperation through the Gulf and Israel. In 2023, she was appointed by Israel's foreign minister to be the first special envoy for innovation. And in her tenure as deputy mayor, she was pivotal in fostering Jerusalem's innovation ecosystem and has been a robust proponent for advancements, Israeli advancements on the global stage. She grew up in Gibraltar, where her father was mayor and chief minister of the British Territory, and she moved to Israel in 2001. And I saw Flora at the Jerusalem, I was telling you the other day, I saw her at the New Jerusalem Library, or Israel Library, at an event where I had to applaud one of the things she did because it was absolutely fantastic. But we'll leave that out of the podcast, won't we? So, Flora, let's start with the Israel-UAE relationship. As you know, co-founder of the Business Council, one of the things that the Gaza war has done is obviously put some strain on that relationship and the relationships that were building up over the period between Israel and the various Gulf countries. How do you see that the war has impacted the relationship generally and the mission of the UAE-Israel Business Council specifically?
So thanks very much. Pleasure to be on the podcast. And I have to say that with all this tragedy and all these very difficult moments that we're going through now as a country, the one little thing, one of the few little things that are giving me hope, the light at the end of the tunnel, is in fact the Abraham Accords relationship. So let me tell you why. It might seem counterintuitive. When the war started, war that we didn't want, we didn't ask for, we didn't expect, caught us completely unprepared, I think it was a shock to the system, not just to Israel, but to those Arab countries that had made peace with us. I don't think they thought that this would actually ever happen. I think one of the reasons why they made peace with us is because they perceive Israel to be a strong country that defends its borders. And we were all worried because over the last 4 years of this relationship, there have always been bumps on the road, and all the bumps of the road have always been a mini war with Gaza, right? And we seem to have gotten over all of them. And so the question at that moment was, were we going to get over this bump in the road? And I've got to say that we have gotten over it. And let me tell you my analysis of why and how. The UAE, same as Bahrain, to a certain extent also Morocco, and a potential Saudi peace treaty in the future, have the same enemies as Israel in the region. So who are those enemies? The main enemy is Iran. Iran wants a Shia domination of the Middle East, and in fact, a caliphate all over the world. They are jihadi fundamentalists. And the UAE, and the Saudis, and the Bahrainis have dealt with their own version of Hamas in their countries.
Yes.
The UAE kicked them out 10 years ago. For Saudi, it's an ongoing struggle, but again, a couple of decades trying to kick them out. And Bahrain, if we remember during the Arab Spring, when the Muslim fundamentalists were trying to basically bring down the monarchy, there were Saudi tanks on the street to protect the monarchy.
Yes.
So they know exactly who Hamas are, and they can't say it too loudly because the Palestinian cause plays very well on the Muslim street, but essentially they know who these monsters are. Secondly, is the fact that they have been de-radicalizing their own populations for a long time. The educational system in the UAE changed, and in Saudi changed, and in Bahrain a little bit. So they have been really making efforts to de-radicalize their countries from this fundamentalist threat that threatens their monarchies as well as us. And if you want to know proof that I'm not just deluding myself with this, is the fact that a month after October 7th, the Arab League, who we haven't heard from for a while, but they're still there, 22 countries tried to pass 3 boycotts, one on American bases in the Gulf, and 2 against Israel, one about rolling back the Abraham Accords, and the third, something else against Israel. And they couldn't get it done. There were 11 countries, including, of course, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Morocco, blocked
those boycotts. Right.
That is progress. Mm. I don't expect marches for Zionism in these capitals. But the fact that they're laying low, they're not condemning us, and the fact that they blocked an Arab boycott on Israel, to me, that's a very good sign. Saudi Arabia is interested mainly in one thing. It's that they want a defense pact with the United States.
Yeah.
And they know that the price they have to pay is peace with Israel, and they're willing to pay that price.
You mentioned strength. And one of the things, obviously, that October the 7th showed was an Israeli weakness, a perception of Israeli weakness, which really I don't think anybody expected. We didn't expect it here in Israel, and I don't think the broader world expected this to happen. Does that change the calculus of Saudi Arabia, for example, or the Gulf countries? Because they were partnering with a robust, highly successful country in defending itself.
So I think it's a two-part answer. First of all, absolutely. In the Arab world, and I think this is something that many Western countries completely misunderstand about the Arabs and the Arab world, there they respect strength. And they respect people who respect themselves. And you'll even hear ABZ, who's the foreign minister of the Emirates, say, "You guys have no idea how you are making your lives harder by being so politically correct towards fundamentals," he said.
Yeah.
His own. And I think that October 7th did shake that image of Israel of being kind of invincible and on top of everything. However, I think we've recovered that just by the fact that we're willing to admit we were caught unawares, and we're heading back.
The robust response of the Israeli army and the fact that we're going after them.
And also the reaction of the Jewish world.
Yes.
I always say that, funnily enough, Israel is the only country that people fly in for a war.
Right.
But they do.
Yes, they do.
They do. World flies
in. In large numbers.
Solidarity trips. And there's already a fund for the reconstruction of the South. The Jewish people are experts at getting knocked down and getting up again. And I think that has neutralized that kind of shaking and, wow, Israel's not invincible. I think we've managed that. But I think what the October 7th has done, now with an impending, hopefully, Saudi peace deal, is that it's made our price for this peace deal higher. That's the problem. The problem is we're going to have to pay a higher price for that. What does that mean? Concessions to the Palestinians. Now, people are constantly harassing us about this two-state solution. And what they seem to miss is that we've offered a two-state solution multiple times, and it's always the Palestinian leadership who've said no. And so I think the question is directed at the wrong party. You don't have to ask Israel about the two-state solution. Ask the Palestinian leadership about the two-state solution and see what they say.
What's the higher price? What's the higher price that Israel is going to be requested to pay? And are the Saudis particularly interested and that's paying that high price, because any, you know, the attempt to establish or to move out of Gaza led to a fundamentalist state there. What is their interest here?
Well, they their only interest in us paying a high price is image in the Muslim world, which is very important. In the Muslim world, rhetoric and image are very, very important. Image of being strong, image of being the leaders of the Sunnis, of the Sunni moderate countries, the most advanced, even within the Gulf, it's a lot of competition, with the other, a lot of competition. And so from the experts that I've spoken to, from my own analysis and from my friends in the region, I do understand the price may be higher now in terms of concessions to the Palestinians. But I don't even think concessions to the Palestinians is even relevant right now, because who are you exactly talking to? Are you talking to Hamas, who said very clearly they want the destruction of Israel and all the Jews around the world, and they don't want Israel to exist at all, and the Saudis hate Hamas? Or are we talking about Mahmoud Abbas, who is the kleptocrat of the century, who has left his people completely desolate whilst enriching himself and his family, and who just doesn't have it in him to even rule properly his own patch, never mind going into Gaza? And so in theory, you know, I'm a believer in the self-determination of the Palestinian people. I don't want to rule over them. I don't want to be in charge of them. I don't want to be responsible for them. But the problem is, they've proven very clearly that they can't govern themselves, because all they do is either make a terrorist base out of the territory they have, or they develop a kleptocracy like in the West Bank. And so who exactly are we supposed to pay this price to? And so maybe the price is higher, but where's the other side?
Yes, the quid pro quo is not quite clear yet. Okay, I want to switch track slightly, because you wear numerous hats. So as your role as Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem, you were very involved in dealing with the multicultural and multi-ethnic parts of the city, and multi-religious parts of the city as well. And you were very much exposed to the Arab-Israeli population of Jerusalem. How, in your view, has this conflict changed the attitude or the calculus of Israel's Arab population, and specifically the population of East Jerusalem?
So let's start with the Arabs in the country. I think that when Hamas attacked that day, they expected two things to happen. One thing, that Hezbollah would join into the carnival and maybe get rid of Israel that day or the weeks ensuing. I think they thought, if Hezbollah can attack from the north, we can attack from the south, then we're really going to make Israel unlivable for the people in the country, and maybe we'll get it all back. I mean,
yeah.
I think that was part of it. But one of the things that they were also counting on was the fact that the 20% of Israeli Arabs would join in and attack Israel from within. Now, what they did was so horrific, so very horrific, that they created the opposite effect, if you ask me. You had all these Arab Israelis saying, oh, no, not in my name. I mean, beheading babies and raping women, it's a step too far for us. And so they caused the opposite effect with the Arab Israelis. You have a lot of prominent Arab Israelis who came out and said, not in my name. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they expected that. And the East Jerusalemite, to a lesser extent as well. And I want to give credit to the administration that I've been part of, and I've just completing my term next week, and I didn't run again, so I'm the outgoing deputy mayor of the Jerusalem. But I want to give credit to the mayor, who over the last 5 years, and of course my beat has been economic development in East Jerusalem, and his beat is mainly infrastructural development. But we've done so much in nurturing ties with the local leadership, in building new parks and schools and infrastructure, and cleaning up East Jerusalem. I've done a lot with Arab women in high tech, and getting them into high tech, and developing female high tech entrepreneurs, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that all that investment that we put in, human as well as infrastructural, is actually holding things together right now.
And what do you hear from that leadership? What do you hear from the community leaders within Arab East Jerusalem?
Again, it's look, there's always going to be radicals in East Jerusalem, and we have had 4 terrorist attacks. And in the last year, we had some very nasty terrorist attacks, and we know where the pockets of fundamentalism are in East Jerusalem. But for the most part, there's been a change in the East Jerusalem population in the last 10 years. And the change is this. They've finally realized that salvation is not coming from the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah. And that, together with the Jerusalem municipality, the Jerusalem Affairs Ministry, holding out their hand and saying, we want to equal the playing field for you. We want to develop. We can't say that this is one city and then under-resource East Jerusalem. We're going to turn a page, which we did. And I think that the combination of the fact that they've seen how useless the Palestinian leadership is, how toxic it is, and the fact that the Jerusalem municipality and the Israeli government have said, what can we do? I think that combination has created a situation where the majority of East Jerusalemites are quite happy to be on this side of the fence.
Right. And in your view, was that a contributory factor in them not joining on October 7th?
100%. They've actually got something to lose. There's a lot of prosperity in the city, in the Arab community. A lot of prosperity. The main builders of the city are Arab developers. So why would they want? And they're very many families, many big families, chamulas as we call them, are very wealthy. Why would they want to ruin that? For what? For loyalty to a leadership that all they do is steal from their own people? They're done. They're kind of done with them a little bit.
Right. And you mentioned your work around technology empowerment in Arab East Jerusalem, women in Arab East Jerusalem. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've achieved? I know that in my career, working with technology companies for many, many years, it's very rare to see Israeli Arabs in those sectors. You do see them in medicine a lot. You see them obviously in construction. There are areas where you see, but not in technology. So what's happened there? And what's happening in the field of women?
So, first of all, the reason I even have a political career is because about 10 years ago, I became an activist in trying to develop the innovation ecosystem for the city of Jerusalem. I got together with some young graduates from Hebrew University who had this vision to create the first ever accelerator in the city. 10 years ago, there was no accelerators in the city. So they created the first accelerator, and I came in as a mentor. I used to be, in my previous life, I used to be a communications consultant, and I used to help startups with their pitches, with their messaging, with their decks. That's what I used to do. That was my previous business. And so I was one of the people who got involved, and then I became an ambassador of this. And the city government at the time was not a particular fan of, you know, making Jerusalem into an innovation hub. And there was no sense not to, because still Hebrew University, the best university in the country, according to any scale, was a place of tremendous innovation. And yet the startups would come out of Hebrew U, they'd move to Tel Aviv. And meanwhile, you have the largest city in the country here, a million people. Whole country is not even 10 million people yet, so we're more than 10% of the population. We also have the most diverse population of the country. We have, in the country, there's 20% Arabs, in Jerusalem, 40% Arabs. In the country, there's 15% ultra-Orthodox, in Jerusalem, 30% ultra-Orthodox. So we are the most diverse city in the country by double of the diversity of the rest of the country. And to me, diversity makes actually for excellent innovation. So we had all the ingredients. We had the intellectual capital, Hebrew University, and Betzalel Arts and Design School, engineering colleges, the largest university city in the country. We have innovation. We needed a community, we needed funding. So we created a community And I was one of those people, created a community, and then funding came. So in 7 years, we've doubled, 10 years, we've doubled the high-tech jobs in the city of Jerusalem. That is no small feat.
That's impressive.
We've created an innovation ecosystem. And now in every college and university, there is an innovation hub or accelerator or something like that. And the last 5 years, once that was built, in the last 5 years, what I've been working very hard in is embracing the minorities into the prosperity of the startup nation, mainly Arabs and ultra-Orthodox and Haredim. And why is this particularly interesting? Because the reason why Jerusalem is a poor city is because we have the lowest workforce participation in the country. Where are the problems? Arab women and Haredi men. And because we have the largest populations of Arabs and Haredim, it brings the whole city down. So, I can sit and help Haredi men, which I do all the time, but I think my value added was with women. Right. And so I created, I co-founded a program to take junior women in high tech, also ultra-Orthodox women and Arab women, and give them and do skills building and mentorship to raise them up the ladder. And we've had enormous success. I've also been involved in creating high tech hubs in East Jerusalem. And I've also been involved in trying to place Haredi and especially Arab women and men also in high tech around the city. So in every big company in the city like Intel, there's a diversity person in HR who we've been constantly in touch with. The city of Jerusalem has created a database of Arab men and women engineers. And we've been working very hard. Remember, the Arabs lack the networks that we have. We, you know, Jews, we have a lot of networks. The army is a big network. They're not part of the army. School is a big network. They're not part of the same school system. And so what we've been doing is artificially creating the networks they need to get the good jobs. And we've been doing that with the city of Jerusalem. And I'm very, very proud of the results that we've had.
Okay. I while we're talking about the diversity of Jerusalem, I do want to touch on one other point, which is a sensitive point, I think, for the city and for the country generally. And that is secular Jews in Jerusalem. And there's been a long-term outflow of the secular residents of Jerusalem, which makes for a poorer city in many ways, economically and socially as well. Is that a reversible trend in your view? And if so, what can be done?
Well, first of all, I want to clear up because I think there's a big panic about the secular leaving the city. And I want to just calm everyone down and talk about what secular means. I mean, do Zionist people who are traditional / religious like me, count? And why do everybody, why do I not count in the kind of working Zionist numbers, which I do? And so the number of secular residents in the city has been pretty steady over the last 5-10 years. And I'll tell you why. We're a capital city, right? And as you know, every capital city in the world has negative migration because people want to buy bigger houses and they can't afford it in the city. So you go out to Mishmish, you go out to different areas around the city, and the center of life remains in the city. I have no problem with that. You may move out, but if your center of life, if this is where you come shopping, to the cinema, take your kids out for dinner, I'm good with that. I don't lose much. I mean, I lose property taxes, but people cost us more than they don't. Yeah, they don't make up for the expense of people. And so I don't have any problem with that. Now, when you analyze the numbers of the negative migration out of the city, you have to also understand that also the ultra-Orthodox are leaving in bigger numbers, in fact, than their proportion size. So there's kind of a myth, the secular leaving the city. First of all, we have a nice amount of immigrants, like me, 22 years ago, 23 years ago, that came to the city. Every year, we have a nice amount of immigrants coming in. A. B, the negative migration includes ultra-Orthodox, who are actually leaving in higher numbers than the rest of it. And C, all the work we've done in terms of creating job opportunities for young university graduates so that we can catch them before they get a chance to go to Tel Aviv, because we're employing them. We've created a high-tech city in the university campuses, mm-hmm. and they're grabbing the third-year engineering students. Why? So they don't leave. And so all of this together, I'm optimistic. I don't think it's such a gewalt panic as what politicians tell you, and things are not as bad as it seems.
Okay, good. All right, so I want to now turn to your role in the foreign ministry. You are the first ever special envoy for your innovation appointed by the foreign minister. Some might view that role as being the purview of other ministries within Israel, you know, the Ministry of Economy and Industry, the Chief Scientist's Office, who've traditionally worked to promote that for Israel. Why has the foreign ministry done this? What are you trying to achieve in this new role?
That's a good question. I think in Israel, what we see a lot is that there are multiple ministries who are, you know, seemingly doing the same job. And God forbid, I'm not here to take anybody's job or authority. All I'm here to do is perhaps connect the dots and be a type of roving ambassador for the startup nation. And originally, when I was appointed, it was in September, before October 7th.
Timing is everything, Flora. Timing is everything.
It's everything. But the idea was that I was going to be, just as I had ushered in the people-to-people peace with the Emirates, I'm also the co-founder of the Gulf Israel Women's Forum. So just as I built these kind of civil society, people-to-people organizations, my role was going to be to amplify that role and continue in the Abraham Accords countries and perhaps also African countries who are very keen. I think what people maybe know less of is that there's many Muslim African countries, or at least half-half Muslim Christian African countries, who are also going through a rapprochement with Israel. And so
and the UAE is a gateway to those countries in so many
exactly.
ways.
Absolutely, to Africa, absolutely. And my role was not going to be to take anybody, usurp anybody's role. What they're doing is important. My role was just going to be to come and bring them in and then pass them on to the other ministries, because I'm very well connected in those worlds, because I can understand other people's mentalities. I'm also a mother tongue Spanish speaker. So Latin America would mm-hmm. have also been a big part of my role. And please God, I'll get back to that once we're over with this horrible war. And, you know, I've kind of been repurposed now for public
diplomacy, yes,
and for representing Israel.
And for those who don't know and haven't seen Flora, which it's you're sort of a little hard to miss. She's been all over social media, all over the mainstream media, as a super effective spokesperson for Israel in this very difficult time. So maybe one last question about that. How have you found that role? It is not easy to get above the noise, get above some of the woke left messages which permeate particularly places like TikTok and other forms of social media, and also the mainstream. How do you find combating that and trying to get Israel's message out and an honest assessment of what it is that we're trying to achieve and the challenges and the very difficult challenges that Israel faces?
Well, you know, it's easy to represent Israel when I know that the truth is on my side. They may not know it, but I know it. It doesn't hurt that I've been trained as a litigator. I'm a barrister by profession. I don't have the wig. I mean, I have it here, but I don't wear it, of course.
Next time. Well, we're going to get you to wear the wig next time.
I trained to be on my feet. That means I trained to be somebody who can quickly retort when difficult questions are asked. That's my training. And that's also, I think, something I'm good at. And so when you have the experience, also I've been I've been essentially the foreign spokesperson for the city of Jerusalem for the last 7 years. And every time something goes wrong on Temple Mount or Sheikh Jarrah or whatever it is, the new blood libel of the day is to do with Jerusalem, which was a big chunk of of what was going on in Israel.
Of course, nothing like this has happened in any of our lives.
Nothing like this. But, you know, one of the reasons I went into politics is because I always saw myself as somebody who could do this, because I always felt that people relate better to people who could actually speak their language as a mother tongue. So you've seen me in English, but I do all of this in Spanish as well.
I wouldn't understand a word you're saying, so there'd be no point in watching.
But you wouldn't. And so that was one of the reasons. When I arrived in Israel, it was the second intifada 23 years ago. My husband and I arrived. We didn't have children yet. The children were born here in Israel. And I would watch the news, or I would watch TV, international media channels, and I would get so frustrated at the very poor performance of Israeli spokespeople. Heavy accents, not understanding the nuance, and very aggressive sounding, too military, too male. And I kept thinking to myself, we need another solution for this. And so I did that for the city of Jerusalem. I've been speaking for years in the press, never to this intensity, of course. And on October the 7th, I was called up by BBC that morning. And when I realized what was going on, and I'm Shabbat observant, but when I realized that we're in the middle of a massacre, nobody was speaking, and the world didn't know what was going on. And at that point, I thought, this is why God has put me in this situation for this moment. And so I gave myself the pikuach nefesh hater. I made my own rabbinical decision.
You can break the Sabbath to save a life.
I thought, yes, I'm going to break the Sabbath to defend my people. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that my obligation, I feel that we have our boys and girls in the front lines defending our country. The least I could do is to use my rhetorical skills to defend my country.
And have done so, I must say, with great effectiveness, and all very thankful. Flor Hassan Nahum, I have about 17 other questions that I wanted to ask you, but we're not going to have time, so we're going to have to leave it till next time. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Darren. It was my pleasure.
It was more mine than yours, I'm sure. For all of you watching, please tune in for more podcasts coming your way, and thanks very much. Bye-bye.